and provide you with as much information as possible. And if necessary, I'll also send you some information from a website that I use that is unbiased, not commercially supported, and provides you with information that you can use in your discussions with your healthcare provider. So I encourage you to call in now, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-2372 from outside our calling area. And I have two questions for you today based on a couple of articles recently published. One was in the journal called Pain that looked at, and this is a question I'm going to ask you, if something is going to hurt, for example, going to get a shot or going to have a specific treatment, and you ask the person who's going to be doing the treatment, is this going to hurt? Do you want to be told that yes, indeed, it does hurt or it will hurt? Or do you want it downplayed? And the reason I mention this is that there's a new study that suggests that merely saying this may hurt a bit before receiving a shot, in this case, inoculation, may be enough to trigger a much greater pain response in the brain before the actual pain itself. That is, you get primed up to feel the pain, and as a result, you feel more pain when you get the shot, which is, for adults, may not be as traumatic as for a child. When a child asks, is this going to hurt? And you say, yes, it is. The child will tend to feel more pain as a result of that. And so in this study, this is what they did. In the first experiment, it was a small study. It was 16 people. So again, small study, needs to be done on a larger population. And they used what was known as a functional magnetic resonance tomography. That is, they were looking at areas of the brain associated with pain sensation and seeing if it lit up and the degree to which it lit up when someone was told something was going to hurt and when you had the actual stimuli. So in the first experiment, the researchers asked the participants to imagine situations that corresponded with certain words associated with pain. For example, things like paralyzing, grueling, excruciating, as well as negative but not pain-associated words such as dirty, disgusting, and neutral and positive words. And in the second experiment, the participants were read the same words but were distracted but with a brain teaser or a puzzle that they were doing while they heard these words at the same time. And the results showed that in both cases, there was a very clear response how the brain processed pain, the pain processing centers with the words associated with pain, but there was no activity in response to the other words. So in other words, pardon the pun, this means that when you prime someone to expect there's going to be pain using words that trigger either memories of a painful experience, they're very powerful and it may make pain worse. So my question to you, because this is a particular conundrum, and again, this is more a theoretical discussion, right, or a hypothetical discussion, because it was only 16 people in this study. But nevertheless, should we downplay pain when someone asks, is this going to hurt? And you're faced with a problem because ethically and morally, you have to be straight with your patients. You have to answer their question directly. You're not supposed to behave in any condescending or paternalistic manner to say, well, no, I don't think this is good for the patient to hear this. I'm going to protect them by not telling them this. That really contravenes the respect in a doctor-patient relationship. And so on the one hand, you're faced with, well, perhaps not telling the child it's going to hurt versus telling them it's going to hurt, they're going to have less pain perception. Do you not tell the child or the parents of that child that this is going to hurt a bit? So I'd like to know your opinion about that, because it does straddle some moral and ethical problems, right? Do you look out for your patient because the goal is not to cause harm to someone? So on one hand, if you don't tell them it hurts, it may hurt a bit less. Therefore, you're doing a bit less harm to them. But on the other hand, If you're not honest with them, you're harming your doctor-patient relationship, and you're not being honest with your patient. So I'm just curious, what would you want in that situation? And the other is a article that has just come out looking at driving and it's from ctv.ca, and it's called Rare Supertaskers Can Balance Driving and Cell Phone. And this was psychologists that looked at 200 people and drivers, and they were asked to use a driving simulator while also having hands-free cell phone conversations that required them to memorize words and solve math problems. And there were three phases to this testing. They used the driving simulator with no distractions. They then had to use the driving simulator. Then they had to perform mental exercises while not driving. And then they combined both. And no big surprise here, the people that were driving, and the study found, as so many other studies have found already, that most people could not drive well while completing difficult mental tasks while talking on the phone. In fact, they took 20% longer to apply their brakes, and they increased their following distance by 30%. Most drivers who are on the cell phone don't tend to speed. They tend to slow down and increase their distance between the driver in front of them. And the ability to do math and the ability to memorize words also suffered. And as a result of that, they twisted the study a little bit and said, how many of this 200 could actually do all this stuff without any deficiency in their performance? And they found only 5 out of the 200, meaning that the greater 97.5% of people in this particular group were not able to do both tasks. So again, it's an interesting little study. It was published in the journal Psychonomic Bulletin and Review. And again, just adds to the information out there that you can't do two things at once. Most people overestimate their ability, and it does interfere with their ability to function in that way and to drive their car. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. We'll be back with James and his question about blood pressure in just a couple of minutes. Is it, how long does that last after you...
Quite a bit. I'm also, the acupuncture treatment also requires me, it doesn't require me, it says this is a diet we would like you to follow, and I've been following it because the acupuncturist said if you follow it, you will achieve your results much sooner, and of course it's fish and no meat. Mm-hmm. Fish. It's a vegetarian with deep sea fish. Period. With nuts to get some protein.
Oh, so it's pretty much like a Mediterranean type diet.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a reasonable diet to have. Certainly no harm at all with that. The lightheadedness, is it always associated when you go for acupuncture?
No, sir. It's daily. Right now, I'm not going every day for my acupuncture, but for the last 3 days, I haven't taken my
You haven't taken your medications.
Medication to reduce my blood pressure because my blood pressure is very low.
Well, how low is it? What is the?
Well, some of them go down to 50, and it starts off at the higher one. It could be 60, and the lower one would be 50. The DIA is 50, and the SYS is sometimes 60, 70.
Okay, now, are you measuring that at home?
Yes, I am. And I've had my little machine. It was a good one. Compared to my doctor's mercury, the doctor said they were identical.
How long ago was that?
Yes, that was about 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay. I would, first of all, for a systolic of 60.
Yes.
That is,
very low.
James, that's very low, and that's fainting. That's not going to keep your body going. Your kidneys don't work when that pressure is that low. It goes below. The kidneys need to have a certain pressure for them to work. I would want to check and make sure that blood pressure monitor, it's now 3 years that you've been using it, and since it's been checked, to just to make sure whether it's still accurate, because you may be, although you're having symptoms, so you indeed, you likely are having blood pressure that is dropping.
Yes.
My concern is that it's giving you an overestimation of how low it's going.
Well, so, I will certainly do that. That's, yeah. This is my question to you.
Right.
Because I on this weekend, Friday was a holiday, Saturday and Sunday and Monday. I don't think my doctor's around.
Mm-hmm.
And my blood pressure on Friday was quite low. Now, I've changed my diet just a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I ate a couple of hamburgers, trying to get some more protein from meat, eh?
Well, meat or fish, protein will come from meat, fish, or chicken. So you don't have to have, if you like to, that's fine, but you don't have to have red meat. You can get a lot of protein from chicken, from fish, from beans and legumes and soy, and there's all sorts of sources.
I eat lots of vegetables,
right,
and nuts and what have you.
Right.
Well, I was going to go to my doctor anyway and ask him what he would suggest.
The other thing to consider, James, is that although the blood pressure, as you mentioned, was fine for a long time,
yes,
and now that you are having fluctuations like this, there's still, as people age, medications can sometimes become more problematic in that the rate at which the medication is broken down and excreted by the kidneys can change. Kidney function tends to diminish as we get older, which is normal. It's not a disease process. It's just simply a normal process. But in that, you may have more of the medication staying around longer periods, as a result, causing more effect on your blood pressure. So I haven't seen anything to suggest that acupuncture is going to reduce blood pressure like that. I would be more inclined to look and make sure that there's no other interactions that are going on, that the medications may have to be adjusted downwards if your blood pressure is dropping too much. And in fact, if there's been a lifestyle change, you're eating better, if you're losing weight, that also can influence blood pressure positively. And as such, medications may, as I said, have to be reduced or even discontinued, one or more of them. But again, that depends on the reading at the office and the matching of that reading with what you're getting on your monitor at home, bring it to the office to see if there are any discrepancies or whether it's accurate.
I'm going to do that maybe on Tuesday, because I don't think my doctor will be here on Monday.
Okay.
And in answer to you, well, thank you very, very much for that, because that's what I thought I'd have to do. And I'll certainly do it, because I don't want to be lightheaded and woozy.
Well,
all the
exactly.
Time.
I mean, and usually, James, usually it is medication related. It's very rare. As I said, I have not read anything to suggest that acupuncture will make you dizzy or lightheaded. Some people will get a reaction just to the fact of thinking of, and that happens with any kind of stimuli where there's a needle that goes, a shot will do that, a vaccine will do that, an injection or acupuncture. Some people just have a reaction to a needle going into their skin and they feel like they're going to faint. And that's a normal reflex. It's called a vasovagal reflex or a fainting spell. And that's simply a normal response that you see for some people, but that's not inherent to the acupuncture or any other thing. It's just the person reacting to that kind of stimuli.
Okay.
But again, this is occurring not when you're getting the acupuncture. You're having this happen on days that you don't even go to it, and not at the time when you have the acupuncture either.
You're right. I do go to my doctor regularly,
yeah,
every 2 months, and he checks everything all the time, eh?
Right. Well, and the other thing that you may want to do as well, just to see what's happening to your blood pressure over the course of a day, is although you can take one reading at the office, and a lot of times it's one reading. I know at our office what we'll do is we'll take five readings with a machine that averages out over about 7 to 10 minutes,
yes,
to get a more accurate reflection, at least because when someone comes into the office, their blood pressure is a little bit up, they've walked in, they could have been in traffic or whatever it was, and they're still coming down from that frustration. So the idea is when you take multiple blood pressure readings over 7 to 10 minutes, the person tends to calm down. The blood pressure tends to drop a bit with each reading.
I call that white coat syndrome.
The white coat is one of them when you're actually in the office. That's very true. So you want to try and reduce that likelihood of a false reading or a reading that's not truly representative of what that person's blood pressure is like.
Yes.
But the other thing that can be done is to do what's known as an ambulatory blood pressure. And that is where you're given a monitor to carry with you that's attached, the blood pressure
yes.
cuff is on your arm,
yes.
and it monitors your blood pressure for 24 hours.
Good.
And that way, it also will have a button that you press, that when you're feeling faint or dizzy, you press that button. And so when they're looking at these readings, they will see what the pressure was exactly at the time that you were feeling that.
Yes.
And so it's a good way of determining how low the pressure is going. And also, it will take a reading, an average, and say, between 7 a.m. and 5 p.m., your average blood pressure is 120 over 75, and only 2% of the time is it over 140, and only 1% of the time it's over a diastolic of 90. And that, again, gives you information saying your blood pressure is very well controlled then. But then it'll take, for example, 5 p.m. to midnight, and it'll do another bunch of readings and give you the averages and say how much it falls into the normal interval. And then at night as well, it'll take the readings while you're sleeping at night. So it gives a very good idea of how your blood pressure is controlled during the day in all sorts of situations, not just in the physician's office, especially if you're having these kind of symptoms. We want to know when it happens and how low it actually is so that we can prevent it from happening again. So the more information that is available, the better idea we have on what to do.
Yes, that's right. Well, thank you ever so much, sir.
Well, you're very welcome, James.
All the best.
All the best. Bye-bye now. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a small break, and then when we come back, we have Alan, who has a question about coenzyme Q10 to counter inflammation. I'm going to give him some information about that and also refer him to a good website that has a lot of information about it. There are some positive findings with coenzyme Q10, but when we look at the evidence, we'll go through that and look at it very dispassionately, unbiased, and give what they found so far with regards to coenzyme Q10 and inflammation. Coenzyme Q10 is produced by our bodies in tremendous quantities. It's very common. It's produced by an organelle called mitochondria. We'll get into that also after the break. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 for our listeners outside of the 613 calling area. A lot of our lines are available. Looking forward to your calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back with Alan and his question on coenzyme Q10 in just a few moments.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by Motion Specialties for all your home health care needs.
Advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we have lots of lines available, and as I've also said many times before, I'd rather be speaking with you than talking to myself for the next 25 minutes. So 521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call. *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 if you're outside the CFRA calling area. And we are going to go to line two, and good afternoon to Alan. Alan, are you there? I don't think Alan is there anymore. Alan, we'll try this one more time. Alan, are you there? Well, we'll put Alan on hold. I don't hear Alan anymore on there. We have a few more calls coming in, but what we'll do is I'm going to cover one other little study. And I also wanted to get back to my question to you about honesty with patients with regards to pain. Do you think, and this was that study I mentioned before, where they found that if you told someone, this is going to hurt a bit when you do something, it can elicit a greater pain response than if you didn't tell them that it was going to hurt a bit. Small study, 16 people using MRIs to be able to determine whether the areas of the brain were stimulated more, pain perception was more. And they found that indeed, if you used words that were highly charged to signify pain, then somehow you were going to feel more pain. So the conundrum is, do you tell people that they're going to have more pain or have pain when you do something? Or do you refrain from doing that, which means they have less pain? The whole idea is not to hurt people when you're treating them, but at the same time, you're damaging or causing harm to the relationship with your patient if you say that there's no pain or there isn't going to be pain, or you don't volunteer the information and you just go ahead and give the shot, especially so when you're dealing with children. So my question to you, if you wish to answer, is what would you want and why? So we're going to try Alan once again and see if Alan is there. Alan, are you there?
Hello, Dr. Hi. Dorkin. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I remember a year ago you diagnosed me with heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
It was about, well, 14, 15 months ago.
Okay.
And then I went for the operation. I got the stent.
Right.
I've been on statins for the last year.
Okay.
I stopped taking the statins. Because there's five major areas that, that there's drawbacks to them. I heard about this new thing called coenzyme Q10. What do you think of it for stopping inflammation or countering inflammation?
Well, the information about coenzyme Q10, when you look at what its proposed uses are for, its uses are purported to be used for congestive heart failure, damage to the heart, heart attack recovery, and hypertension. But nothing mentioning inflammation. So there isn't anything with regards to countering inflammation. But I'm curious, Alan, so you had the blockage of your blood vessel in the heart and you stopped the statins. What information was available to you that led you to say, I don't want to take the statin anymore?
Well, there's five major areas that the statins will affect your body, right?
Well, what areas? I'm just trying to find, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just trying to find out what those specific concerns that you have are. What areas were they mentioning?
I mean, one thing, it depresses the immune system. Number one, right?
Haven't heard of it doing that.
No?
No indication that it would do that. What a statin is it blocks a particular enzyme. This enzyme is called HMG coreductase, meaning that that enzyme helps the liver make cholesterol. So this particular medication blocks that enzyme, hence you get less cholesterol. But it doesn't really interfere with the body's immune system with regards to preventing or protecting you from disease and such. So there's nothing in it that way that will do that.
In the long-term studies, don't more people die from cancer if they're on statins than if they're not on statins?
No information about that either. In fact, most people, when you look at the death rates in North America, more people die of heart disease than they die from cancer. That's the first thing about 40% more people will die from heart disease than cancer in terms of cause of death. No indication that taking statins long-term leads to cancer, again, because it's a very targeted medication. It targets this one specific enzyme system. And the long-term effect of using statins is it reduces the risk of experiencing another heart attack or progression of the plaques that continue to build up in the coronary arteries that can lead to another heart attack. So over the long term, it reduces the risk of dying from heart disease. And I think where that information may be coming from, Alan, is that if you're preventing heart disease in people who potentially develop cancer, then they may die from cancer because they're protected from the heart disease. So their heart disease doesn't get them. But the longer you live, the more chances you have of getting cancer. That's just...
Are you saying there's really no drawbacks to statins?
What I'm saying is that the evidence to statin use, especially for somebody who has had a stent put in, where they have known coronary artery disease, that puts you in a specific risk category that's very high for another heart attack. And so in that instance, a statin is one of a few medications that are used to try to reduce your risk of another heart attack because you've already had damage to your heart. And so in that situation, the benefits of using a statin far outweigh any of the theoretical risks of it because we know that without that statin use, your risk of another heart attack is about 1 in 5 in the next 10 years.
Well, I didn't actually have a heart attack, right? It was 99% blocked, but I didn't have a heart attack.
Right, but another few weeks to months and you probably would have, because the mechanism that led to the heart attack was the blockage, or the mechanism that could lead to a heart attack is the blockage, and that is still ongoing. That's part of who you are, and that type of process is what that heart is prone to. So you're trying to block the normal, what we call the pathophysiology, or the mechanism of the disease that leads to blocked arteries. We want to try to arrest that, stop that from happening, so that you don't advance and block an artery to the point where you end up with a heart attack. And so the statin was given as a means of preventing it. And by not having the statin, as you've seen, you weren't on a statin before and you had a 99% blockage. And so by not being on a statin now, you run the risk of that same process continuing and causing a 99% blockage somewhere else. So what that statin is doing is, in many cases, depending on the blood tests that are done to check your cholesterol levels, long-term use of a statin has been demonstrated to actually increase the opening of the artery, to actually prevent the plaque from blocking up the artery. And the longer it is used, the better the response you get. In fact, you get a widening of the artery, that is, the blockage tends to disappear, or at least regress, to the point that blood is able to flow through unhindered, the longer the statin is used. And that's based upon, there was one study called the Asteroid Study. And then there's a few other studies that have come out. And each one shows that the more you reduce cholesterol levels in people, and this is specific for people who have coronary artery disease, not for people who have found to have high cholesterols, but their arteries are still relatively patent or open, but for people who are at high risk, that it dramatically reduces the risk of developing heart disease or heart attack by the mechanism where the arteries get blocked up. So
you're saying it's truly a miracle drug for against heart attack?
Not a miracle drug. Simply, I never tout one thing as the be-all and end-all, because that would be disrespectful and disingenuous to people. Rather, we go by what the evidence is today on how to best manage someone who is at high risk for heart disease. And so what the statin does in your particular situation, because of the history, is that it will have a nice effect at reducing your risk of developing those blockages in the arteries. But that is also taken in context with other medications. People who take aspirin, for example, every day with it. There are medications, or actually diets that people do, or not, I don't like to use the word diet, but lifestyle changes and how they eat make a huge difference. Lots of fish oil in your diet will make a big difference. Exercise, not smoking, lots of fruits and vegetables.
Well, I found I was tended to bruise or bleed too much. How important is the aspirin as well as a statin?
What aspirin does is that aspirin will reduce the stickiness of platelets. Platelets are little pieces of cells or little cells in your bloodstream that, when they are activated, when you cut yourself, for example, platelets adhere to the area where the cut is to help in the formation of a clot. So wherever there is inflammation or damage to the skin or to an artery, they will congregate because the damage sends out a chemical signal. The platelets go there, they bind to it, and they form a small clump. What aspirin does is it reduces the stickiness of the platelets and reduces the likelihood of having a clot form in the artery. So it's one, again, each thing deals with a specific part of the mechanism or disease mechanism that leads to blockages in the arteries. So the cholesterol lowering agents, the statins, do one thing. The aspirin does another. If someone has high blood pressure, they will take a medication to reduce their blood pressure because that has an effect on heart disease. There's a whole slew of things that are taken in combination with managing the potential for a heart attack or for heart disease. And so one drug is not the be-all and end-all, but when used in combination and it's explained to a person why it's important to do that, it gives a much better chance at reducing risk as opposed to just depending on one thing and one thing alone.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Alan. All the best. And we're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we have Micheline wants to talk about equilibrium, and Aline has a question about hair loss and birth control. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to the Sunday House Call. We'll be back after these messages.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by Motion Specialties for all your home health care needs.
Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we are going to line one, and good afternoon, Micheline.
Bonjour, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
God bless. I have a question. I'm not sure whether I'm pronouncing this well, equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to know what is equilibrium. It's sort of like, that's why I'm saying I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly. It's sort of like dizziness, what have you.
Right.
So what is equilibrium? Why is there no symptoms or signs? It just happens and goes away.
Okay. Well, equilibrium simply means balance. It's not a medical term per se. It's more of a description of a position. So when something is in equilibrium, it means it's balanced. So when you're standing, you feel great. You don't feel like you're going to tip over or lean over to one side or feel like you're going to fall. So that's what equilibrium means. But there are certain conditions that can destabilize or knock someone over or make them feel very dizzy, where they lose their equilibrium. That is, they lose their ability to balance. And so in this case, many things can do that. You can feel dizzy by a sudden drop in blood pressure. Commonly what you can see that happens is that someone takes a hot shower. When you take a hot shower, your blood vessels over the surface of your body will dilate to bring more blood to the surface of your skin in order to radiate heat away because your body is overheating. But when your blood vessels do that, your blood pressure drops. And when your blood pressure drops, less blood flows to the brain. When less blood flows to the brain loses its ability to function. And so a person either feels like they're going to faint, or they feel lightheaded, or they feel like they're going to fall over. And when they lie down, that goes away because their blood pressure, their blood flow resumes to the brain. That's one way that can happen. Other things that can do that, ear infections can do that because of the pressure that occurs behind the eardrum. The balance organs are right around that area, and so the pressure on there can make someone feel dizzy or the room spinning. Infections to the actual balance organs or inflammation to the balance organs can cause a feeling like you're going to lose balance. A loss of salt or getting dehydrated, that is having diarrhea for a while where you lose salt and sugar and water, can also lead to dizziness because the blood pressure will drop. Your sodium levels or electrolytes.
Electrolyte, what does that mean?
Electrolytes describe things like minerals, like sodium and potassium and chloride. That's what an electrolyte is. It's an ion or a part of a mineral that's in our bloodstream. And
does that mean that one is missing of that?
It can be where that is missing, but usually, all things considered, if someone mm-hmm. is not on any medications and is relatively healthy,
yes.
it's very rare to see electrolytes imbalance. So usually your sodium is okay, your potassium is good. Things are going to be pretty normal. What I'm trying to do is just outline to you all the different things that can lead to, among others, that can lead to a change in balance perception. So the most common thing that you tend
blood
to
pressure.
See is blood pressure.
Yeah.
And usually you will also see that if someone has been sitting for a while or lying down for a while and they get up very quickly
mm-hmm.
and they feel like they're about to black out or they feel dizzy, they feel like a black veil comes over their eyes.
But it's in the morning, like it happened only once
mm-hmm.
and it was in the morning and it's sort of like I woke up like
yeah.
normally and my cat, hello and everything
right?
else. And holy jeez, I thought I was having a heart attack. Ed, the room was
spinning
and I had to feed the cat, but I went on my knees and as soon as I woke up, it's like everything was spinning and it's sort of like weird and it went away like I was sick, mm-hmm. vomiting and everything else, mm-hmm. and it went away.
How long did that last?
One day, the first day that it happened, mm-hmm. I was really sick and everything else, and the next day I said to myself, relax and mm-hmm. everything else, and then it's gone.
Okay. When it did happen, though, did you find that if you turned your head a certain way, it would make it worse?
Yeah. Well, when I was in bed, and, mm-hmm. and usually in the morning you're in bed and you get up,
mm-hmm.
and as soon as I turned my head and it was spinning,
okay.
I turned my head on the other way and it was spinning, and it's sort of like, oh my God, what's happening?
It felt like you were on a roller coaster.
Oh my God, yeah.
So what you're describing is a temporary blockage or something that interfered with the function of the balance organs in your ear. These are called they're called the semicircular canals only because they look like small circles connected together. And if they get, they're filled with fluid, and sometimes if there's a little crystal that blocks one of the tubes in these balance organs, it can cause this type of symptom, but it can tend to resolve fairly quickly. So that seems to be what happened, especially if you were able to cause that sensation by turning your head. That's likely what happened, but then that crystal settled out and reversed the whole thing, returned to normal. So that's likely what happened. It's not a disease. It's not a disorder that is going to cause more deterioration. It certainly can happen again, but it's not a disease process. It's not something that's going to do you harm over the long term.
But is it a good idea that I check my blood pressure? Because you said that sometimes if your blood pressure is down, that maybe this will happen? But
You could, but it's unlikely to be due to the blood pressure because you were lying down.
Yes.
And so when you're lying down... That's right. You were lying down.
I woke up to a nightmare.
And when you are lying down, your blood pressure is going to be pretty stable. And the fact is that when you moved your head, that's when it got worse.
God, yes.
And so it's unlikely to be blood pressure in that case.
It never happened again, but every time I wake up in the morning,
You want to be careful.
Yes,
that's right.
I pop my eye up and I say, do I see normal and everything's good? So I wake up.
Okay. Well, Micheline, I think that's what happened, is that you had just something blocking your balance organ for that day, but then seemed to resolve on its own.
You made my day.
Okay.
Take care.
You too.
Happy Easter.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to line 3 and speak to Aline. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
I have a 15-year-old daughter who's taking a less mm-hmm. because of severe cramps.
Yes.
Now, she's experiencing hair loss. I mean, it's starting to be noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
She's had thyroid tested, B12. Her ferritin is 39.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the only new thing, the LS.
Okay.
Now, is there any other pill that might not have hair loss as a side effect?
Well, it's interesting because when you look up for side effects for LS, they mention that they have a whole bunch of other things it can have with birth control pills in general. So the LS is a lower estrogen content,
right.
But there isn't any specific association with hair loss and LS. Doesn't mean that there isn't. It's just that it's been so rare that they're unable to say with certainty that there is a correlation between using the pill and hair loss. Nevertheless, the one way to find out is obviously to stop the birth control pill to see if the hair growth comes back. Was she using anything else to control her pain that she was having during her period?
Yes, Ponstan.
Okay, and was that helping at all?
Yes, to a certain extent, but it also hurts her stomach.
Okay, because...
I mean, and the cramps were severe. I mean, one time I really thought it might have been her appendix.
Yeah, so she was really suffering.
Yes.
Because there are other means to try and control pain. I mean, if we're trying to find out whether the pill is doing this, because any pill will do this if... It is indeed because of, in this case, if it's a less that's caused the hair loss, any birth control pill will cause the same effect.
Oh.
So switching to something else is unlikely to change things. So the reason I'm mentioning, if she can, to stop the pill and before she does that, to speak to her physician about other pain control measures, because Ponstan is not the only thing you can use. There are other medications, for example, you can use Celebrex, which won't hurt the stomach as much. You can combine Celebrex with Tylenol or acetaminophen, and that may help in combination control her pain, because what we're trying to find out without her suffering is whether the birth control pill has led to the hair loss or whether she continues to lose hair despite being off the birth control pill, because that answers a question if that's the case. She can then resume the pill, and then usually it's a dermatologist that is seen to try and help figure out what's causing that hair loss.
Yeah, we have an appointment at the end of May.
Right.
But, you know, I thought maybe there'd be another pill that would not have this as a side effect.
It's unlikely because each pill, I mean, there's only one pill that doesn't have estrogen associated with it, and it has just progesterone. So there is that that can be done. But all the other birth control pills have a combination of varying dosages of or concentrations of the various estrogen and progestins in them. They all have that. It's just sort of each one has a different effect on women. Women have different physiologies and biochemistries and endocrine systems. And so whereas one pill would be very agreeable to one woman, it may not suit another. And that's why there are different kinds out there. But again, if we're looking at the side effect profile of the pill, when you look up unestablished side effects, it still comes up. Hair loss is mentioned from time to time. So it can be any pill that will do that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your help.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It was nice talking to you.
Likewise. All the best, Eileen. Bye-bye
now.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
My apologies to John. Can't get to your call today. My thanks to Phil Godreau, tech and producer of Sunday House Call. And we will be back next week with edition number 299, getting close, of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is presented by the Riverstone Retirement Communities of Oak Park and Bridalwood Trails, your complete continuum of care.